it's gotten way worse in the past 5 years for sure. You know, there's a lot of sharks that are definitely getting more educated with more boats fishing, you know, and, you know, they've a lot of big duskies in particular, you know, have gotten dialed in certain areas. When these tunas get in certain areas, that's, you know, they're going to be there. And that's one thing that's really made me jump for like from my, like the gear that I use and that big braid and big mono, you know, 250 pound mono, you know, leader, so that when I hook these 150 pound fish, I can get them to the boat in minutes, you know, and not feed them to sharks.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. This episode of the Six Ranch Podcast is brought to you by DECKED. That's D-E-C-K-E-D. If you don't know what that is, DECKED is a drawer system that goes in the bed of a pickup truck or a van, and it'll fit just about any American-made pickup truck or van. It's a flat surface on top, and then underneath, there are two drawers that slide out that you can put your gear in, and it's going to be completely weatherproof, so I've never had snow or rain or anything get in there. There's also a bunch of organizational features like the deco line, and there's boxes that you can put rifles or bows or tools, all different sizes. There's some bags and toolkits. There's a bunch of different stuff that you can put in there. But the biggest thing is you can take the stuff that's in your back seat out of your back seat and store it in the drawer system, and it's secure. You can put a huge payload of a couple thousand pounds on top of this deck drawer system. There's tie downs on it, so you can strap down all your coolers and your four wheeler and whatever else you've got up there. It's good stuff. This is made out of all recycled material that's 100% manufactured in America. And if you go to decked.com/sixranch, you'll get free shipping on anything that you order. This show is possible because companies like DECKED sponsor it. And I would highly encourage you to support this American-made business and get yourself some good gear.
All right, so last week I was in the Florida Keys fishing with some buddies, some of whom I've fished with for over 20 years. We're in Marathon Key. We went up to the Everglades and did some snook fishing, did some red fishing, saw a freaking crocodile. If y'all didn't know that there's crocodiles in America, there are. There's saltwater crocodiles in the Everglades. Spent a bunch of days offshore as well, and we even caught a sailfish while we were bottom fishing for snapper on super light gear. Freaking incredible. This thing jumped clean out of the water 8 times. Sailfish, Atlantic sailfish, are a really special animal because they're the fastest swimming fish in the water. They can swim 68 miles an hour, which is faster than a cheetah can go on land. And then I flew straight from there to New Orleans, had some great Cajun food, and then came down to Venice, Louisiana, where I am now, with Triple Tail Charters, and we did a couple days of tuna fishing. We did one day of inshore fishing for redfish today. We've got one more day of inshore fishing. I have with me Cade and Blake from Triple Tail Charters, and we're going to talk stories a little bit, but I want to set the scene for what my first experience was like going out tuna fishing. So we meet in the harbor, in the marina. We get on this gorgeous catamaran, 38-foot aluminum boat, just an absolute battle wagon. And we start to head out the end of the Mississippi River and into the Gulf of Mexico. And it's starting to get a little bit gray, dusky. And then when that sun rose, seeing that sunrise over the Gulf honestly made me feel like I'd never seen a sunrise before in my life. Like, that was incredibly special. And there's just colors that occur there that are impossible in the mountains. You know, we just can't see that. So we're going out there. We've got about an hour long run. Things are, you know, just going along. And I'm sitting on a beanbag in the stern of the boat, just looking over the gunwales occasionally at the sunrise. And then all of a sudden I hear these four engines on the back of this boat freaking rev up to everything that we've got. Mm-hmm. And that boat started flying across the surface, and we made a little direction change. and I can't tell what's going on in the cockpit, but I know something just happened, right? Like, this isn't normal. We're running out to fish type stuff. And then the engines cut back and Blake goes, all right, boys, get those bean bags to the front of the boat. We got tuna breaking. And I look out and there are freaking 200-pound yellowfin tuna jumping out of the water in a line for what felt like horizon to horizon. And the surface of the water is just erupting in foam from these fish crashing bait balls. And you and Kyle, your mate, man, you got gear out just so fast. Like, the boat was barely off plane and you had the outriggers out and you're getting baits in the water. All your gear was lined up, ready to go. And I mean, we started going through these huge crashing fish and I'm just standing in the bow of the boat like, what in the hell is going on? And then freaking the reel starts burning drag and it was on just like that. Dude, I know that big game fishing is a different deal. And a lot of people don't know, you know, they think fishing is an activity where universally you're going to go out and you're probably going to experience success. But when you're looking for the biggest yellowfin that there are, it's a different deal, right? Your mindset has to be different. Talk to me about what was going through your head, because you just come off 5 days of nothing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's been hit or miss, and it's high risk, high reward type fishing, you know. So when you see an opportunity, you know, you got to capitalize because it'll shut down quick. So
sure.
When it's happening, it's game on.
And legitimately, we had like half an hour of a bite, and then that was it.
Yep, that was it. Just like I was thinking, you know, around the moon and everything with the full moon, it's been tricky. Sometimes it can be the best ever or be, you know, hit or miss. And when you see them like that, it's as fast as you can get them.
So, you know, I've guided forever, and I know what it's like to have a dry spell. Unfortunately, the guys who'd been here before us, this was their fourth year coming out, still have yet to catch a fish, and that's just how it is.
Yep.
But we hit it right, you know, just pure luck. But, I mean, what must have been going through your mind is like, man, here's our chance. Like, we've got to make it happen right now.
It's a lot of pressure, you know.
And realistically, from my crew, the pressure is in your mind, right?
Yeah.
Because we're out here to have a good time. You know, this is a new experience. It's just something that we want to be a part of. Whether we boat fish or not, not that big of a deal. Like, we're not going to be sour if we don't kill fish.
Yeah.
But I know that also in the mind of the guide or the captain, it's like, we've got to get this done, right?
Yep.
Yeah. But you did it. So, I mean, talk to me about like how you line your gear up so that you can capitalize on that opportunity like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way we're geared up now, you know, while we're trolling, like, it's really just all beefed up heavy gear to where when we do hook a fish, our odds are really good of landing it, you know. So if I get two or three bites the whole day, you know, that's usually all we need, you know, to make us have a good day.
But, you know, heavy gear for, you know, dudes out west who are trout fishing, that might mean that they're throwing 8-pound test instead of 6-pound test.
Yeah.
What do you mean by heavy gear?
I mean, I like using like 130-pound braid and 130-pound top shot, 200-pound leader, you know, minimum for 100-plus-pound tunas, you know.
And how big are these hooks?
Like size 10, big J hooks.
10-aught.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The other 10.
Oh, yeah.
Because when we're fly fishing, if I'm throwing a number 10, I'm like, damn, that's a big hook today.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is 10 in the other direction.
Yep.
Yeah. You like J hooks over circle hooks?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Way more. Yep.
Is there a time and a place for circle hooks or just not?
There is. Like, if you're like these, the feeding, like how these tunas feed changes by the day, honestly. But years ago, we used to catch them all chunking, you know, and we're hiding the hooks in the meat and cutting and doing a little chum slick and running lines out. So, then we would use circle hooks, you know, and that's almost every time gets them in the corner of the mouth.
Yeah.
You know, so that I like circle hooks, but if I'm trolling, I like big J hooks for sure.
Right on. Cade, what's your story?
What do you want to know?
When did you start guiding?
I started guiding right out of high school.
Okay.
So I graduated in 2020
yep.
with, due to COVID, we got out early.
Yeah.
So I did all my captain's license stuff online. got out of school, got my license, and took a little while with Coast Guard. So I did a little bit of pipeline work, grass cutting in between. And then once that license came in, it was time to get to work, and then been fishing since.
Have you fished your whole life?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're from down here, so we that's all we know, fishing and hunting.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, that is this place. There's all kinds of oil work, but besides that, from a natural resource perspective, this place really exists because of the sport fishing.
Yeah,
no doubt.
Yeah. How did you get into tuna?
So, I mean, I've grown up fishing my whole life as well. You know, started with bass fishing when I was younger and jumping around fishing ponds, and then trout and reds, and I kept getting to, you know, bigger and meaner fish, and then snapper and king mackerels. I grew up offshore fishing for years. I didn't know anything else existed out there. And then I finally got made friends with some guys that tuna fished, you know, when I was a little bit older, around like 17. And I seen tunas blowing up on the surface for my first time. And that was it. You know, I was hooked. That's all I cared about.
Yeah.
You know, and then got into the sword fishing as well. And just, it's something that you're always learning every day, even doing it full time, you know. So that's,
talk to me about swordfish.
So the sword fishing is definitely one of a kind, you know, with the style you're fishing, you know, off the shelf where it drops off anywhere from 1,000 to 1,700 foot of water, and your bait's 100 foot off the bottom is what you fish, you know.
Wow.
And so you're dropping a bait down there with a 4-pound lead, and you're just watching the rod, and it's just, when you get a bite, it's just a little bitty tap, you know, but that's like a vicious attack. That sort, with that much line out, you got, you know, 16, 17, 1800 foot of line out, and that rod bounces, like that sword just knocked the shit out of that bait.
Yeah.
You know, so as soon as you see that, you gotta, you know, I like to rip it away and, you know, get them fired up.
So he's coming up there and bashing that
yeah,
bait.
They're going to come up and whack it and try to kill it. And sometimes they cut it in half.
Really?
You know, I'll find my baits where they ate half the bait, and then they still come back and eat the other half with the hook in it.
Wow. I've
had that plenty of times.
Now, we've got a swordfish skull in the yard right now.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't, probably.
Yeah.
The eye on that thing is like a tennis ball.
Yeah.
And there's got to be close to zero light at that depth.
100%. That's what's so amazes me is, you know, them being able to pick up light and see. I don't know how they do it, but they can see down that deep when it's 100% pitch black down there, you know. But a lot of the bait and life that lives down there actually puts off like luminescence, and they kind of glow and stuff like that. So who really knows? They don't know, you know. A lot of people think they know about them, but there's so much unknown down there.
Dude,
that's what's really cool.
And another thing that's just crazy to me about the swordfish, and you said that this is kind of universal amongst the pelagic fishes, is that they can come from 1,500 or 1,600 feet of water to the surface,
yeah,
like a rocket.
Yep.
You know, if you pull a grouper out of 60 feet of water, he's sick. Dead. You know, his
yeah.
swim bladder expands too much because gases expand as you ascend in a water column. But you said they come up to the surface and jump from that kind of depth.
Yeah. So you'll hook them, and sometimes you can barely keep up with them with as fast as they'll swim up. And then they start swimming, they lift that lead. So then now the lead's pulling down on them. So that fish is wanting to pull the direction, whatever, pull the opposite of what's pulling on him. So if you don't keep up with them quick, they'll race up real fast, which they'll still do it even when you get tight sometimes. But I like to try to get tight just to keep them down, you know, because I'd rather not even have them race up, because I know, you know, he's just going to shoot up and then try to shoot right back down. But, you know, I like to let them know that they're hooked right out the gate.
Probably the closest most people have ever come to a swordfish is watching The Perfect Storm, right?
Yeah.
But this isn't commercial long line, and this is rod and reel. Are you using electric reels, or are people fighting these things?
No, they're fighting them, which we fight a lot out the rod holder, but we do use all conventional, you know, and it's not like one person fighting the fish. I mean, this could be, you know, depending on the size, it can go from anywhere from 45 minutes to two and a half hour battle, you know, with these fish. So it's definitely teamwork.
How does the strength of a swordfish compare to the strength of these, you know, 190 plus pound tuna we've been catching?
So a tuna is is typically pretty predictable kind of on what it's going to do. And a swordfish can be as well, but early in the fight, like a swordfish is going to do, can do some just absolutely crazy stuff, you know, with charging the boat, shooting away, shooting back under the boat, just, you know, launching out the water. It's, you know, so it's really neat.
So is swordfish your biggest passion in fishing?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, I couldn't pick between the two, but the big,
let's say if you had to, like, you live in a world where
I couldn't do it.
Like,
I really could.
Cade's got a gun to your head and he's like, look, you've got to pick yellowfin tuna or swordfish. Are you going to take the bullet?
I mean, whichever one I'm doing, that's the one I'm happy with doing. I'm not thinking about the other one, you know? So it's just like hunting and fishing, you know, when I fish all year and then I get off and then I start hunting, it's like, I'm just chasing deer and that's on my mind. And I'm just, you know, that's what I'm caught up in. And I'm so dialed in and thinking about it. It's just, there's nothing else, you know, I don't know.
Well, we absolutely hammered the redfish with you today.
That was a good day.
I mean, that was incredible. And I know that it's an off day compared to what you're used to, but I caught more redfish today than, you know, what I might've caught in the last 10 years or longer. Like that was phenomenal, and we're going to get to that.
Yep.
But before we get to that, we, Blake, got to talk about yesterday.
Yeah.
Dude.
It was gnarly.
That was a record book. That was a record book day.
Yeah, it really was.
So to start out, we decided to leave early to try and catch that bite.
Yeah.
Got there at sunrise. Another beautiful sunrise. Couldn't find the fish.
No.
Right?
Non-existent, yeah. We got where we were the day before, you know, everything rigged up and ready, more ready than we could ever be, you know, and get there and it's, the water got dirtier and there's a couple fish and some bait popping around, but it's just, you know, it's not right, you know, and it's like, we're going to fish it. You know, we caught a blackfin and missed another big blackfin, which is cool, but you know, I'm wondering where these big yellows are. And you know, we then sat there for a while and I'm like, I know they got to be doing it somewhere. And I seen a couple boats just reel their stuff up and take off. And these are guys, some other boats that I know, you know, they're good at what they do, you know, and there are other captains down here. And I was like, wait, we're gone, reel them up. I know they just got a good report, you know? So we just take off and, you know, we're running and I'm like, we go like 10, 12 miles. I'm like, what are these guys doing? You know, we don't even, none of us ever fish in this direction, you know? But I know they're not just going for nothing. So I'm like, hell with it. You know, let's go find out. We got nothing to lose, you know, nothing else is happening. So we make the move and then off in the distance, I see the boat start slowing down. So I'm like, there's got to be something, you know, and we get closer and then we see fish blowing up and I'm like, holy shit. You know, I don't know if that's the school of tunas. I think about it every day, you know,
right.
But do they move 20 miles overnight, you know, 22 miles? I don't know, but it blows my mind, you know.
They sure could. So I want to paint the picture for what this looks like tactically. So, you know, we're seeing fish jump out of the water, sometimes from quarter mile, half mile away, and we're flying over there going 40 to 60 miles an hour and pull up. While the boat's coming off plane, you and Kyle are both running up to the bow and grabbing spinning rods with a popper and
swim baits
on a jig head. And as soon as you're in range, you're hucking it out there into these bait balls. And in these bait balls, you've got, you know, thousands and thousands of, you know, of small bait fish, stuff that's the size of your hand. And kind of inside the middle of that is, on some of them, was just a swarm of sharks. Like the water would just be brown with sharks. And then on sort of the outsides and the corners, you'd see these big yellowfin. And dude, these fish are the size of me. And they're coming out of the water, turning sideways, jumping clear out of the water. It is a spectacle. And you're throwing in there. But, you know, you kept having to, like, throw. You'd get one cast in and then run back and operate the boat again. Yep.
Get on the school.
And sometimes these fish would only be up for 30 seconds.
Yep.
Right? Maybe less. And then you're going and trying to get us back on the school as it's moving. And I felt like some of these schools were moving 10, 20 miles an hour a lot of times.
No doubt.
So for 2 days, I kept asking, like, hey, can I grab one of those spinning rods? And I get it. Like, I've, you know, dealt with a lot of clients. Like, I get where you're coming from. Like, you've played this game before. You know that this is going to be a disaster.
Yep.
And I finally just caught you at a weak moment. And you're like, yeah, there's a third one over there. Give it a shot.
So, first cast.
So I grab this thing. First cast, like 3 seconds in, I go, I'm tight. And you said, set the hook. And I, you know, I was like, man, that seems crazy to me. I'm already putting, like, you know, my full body weight of pressure on this. And I set the hook, and that fish got pissed about it. And the reel seat blew up, right?
Yeah.
So where the reel connects to the rod exploded, and this reel shoots up to the first guide and is right in my face, and the guide, like, mashes over.
Yeah, and it's hung up on there.
Dude, and you go, you lost him, and you reached over and grabbed the reel and tried to pull on it. And
it stuck.
It wouldn't go, right?
Yeah.
And both of us were like, it just wasn't computing, you know?
Because it's the line's still tight.
Because
yeah,
there was,
move it.
Yeah, because as it turned out, there was a 186-pound fish on the end of it.
Yeah.
So we finally get this reel pulled down, and then line goes slack. Again, we think he's gone. Line gets tight. We're like, okay, like, this
couldn't
needs to happen.
It. Yeah.
So I grabbed that reel between the fingers of my left hand and held it against the rod and started trying to crank on it. And we're looking everywhere in the boat for anything that we could find. And you had a roll of electrical tape.
That was it.
Right? So you're running the boat trying to keep up with this tuna that's
chasing it down,
going bonkers. Yeah. And Kyle is wrapping this electrical tape around in there. But, you know, we could never, like, get it on there that well. So every time you turned the reel, the top of the reel would go left and right. And, man, it was just twice as hard to reel on that fish. And we ended up having to take turns on the reel with just about everybody on the boat. And I cut the hell out of my hand trying to hold on to it. And at one point, I was gripping the reel to the rod with both hands while another guy was cranking on it. And
it was chaos.
Dude, we finally get fish up to the boat. You grab the harpoon and harpooned this thing like it was a freaking blue whale.
Yeah.
Dude, amazing.
That
one of the most amazing fishing experiences of my life.
No doubt about it.
You know, a lot of people are afraid of chaos and stuff, like getting really Western. Like, they kind of want that controlled adventure.
Yeah.
But something like that makes it so much more memorable.
No doubt about it. The whole story, you know.
Dude.
It's just something that's burned in your memory forever.
So then we pick up another one on a trolling rod, right?
Yeah.
And we get that thing in, and it is, you said, one of the longest tuna you've ever caught.
Yeah, it was. Like, if it carried its weight for the length of the fish, it would have been, you know, 230, 240, you know, if it was built right. You know,
it was still an absolutely stunning fish. You know, probably in that 5.5-foot range somewhere in there, close to 6 feet maybe. I didn't ever tape it. So, you know, he ate conventional tackle, which, like you said, you have just tremendously powerful gear on the boat to deal with that. We get him in, and it's like, okay, we're having a good day. We've got two monster tuna in the box. And then we pulled up on another bait ball, and at that point I wasn't even asking permission anymore, and I grabbed another rod, and first cast into that one, I got another one.
Yep, back on.
Dude.
It
phenomenal.
Was insane.
And that fish
ran that one.
No that fish ran crazy hard too. He ran a long ways.
Yeah, it did.
Got tail wrapped.
Yep. Ran straight out at the surface, and that's usually when you see them get tail wrapped. You know, they get straight away from you like that, and they start turning back and diving around, going different directions. And once they get wrapped up and you start pulling them backwards, it's pretty much game over. You know, I've seen them come back to life if you don't gaff them good right at first, but that's you know, it's not a bad situation on light tackle for sure.
When do you make the decision between harpoon and gaff?
I mean, when I have a fish coming in tail wrapped, a harpoon shot's really hard because, you know, they're long ways, you know, facing straight away. So I know if I hit that fish with a dart, he could get a second wind and kind of wake up when they're coming in backwards. And so I like to wait for a gaff shot then, but if I get a shot with a dart, you know, on a fish pinwheeling and laying sideways, and I'm not scared to throw it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Man, that was phenomenal. And the whole fleet, I think, had a good day yesterday.
Yeah. No, like, it was good. That was across the board.
Just incredible. I looked up the price of yellowfin right now, and it's between $35 and $50 a pound.
Insane.
Which I think is worth it because the quality of that meat is, it's just phenomenal.
Yep.
It's no doubt. One of my favorite things to eat. Do you get tired of it?
Nah. I mean, I eat, you know, the red meat, you know, with deer and wild game that I hunt all season. I grind a bunch of deer up and I probably eat, you know, I'd say I eat 60, 70% of that. And then the rest, you know, is fish. So, you know, I mean, I love it. I eat it a bunch, you know. I don't buy any meat from the grocery store, so I live off, you know, the wild game and fish for sure.
When did you feel like when did you feel like yesterday was shaping up to be as good as it was?
Once we got that first one in the boat after all the chaos, I mean, I thought, you know, our day wasn't going to be bad. Our day was made on that fish, but I still wanted, you know, I wanted some more, you know. So it's once we got into that second school and they got fired up and we got those last two bites, I mean, that really just was icing on the cake.
Yeah. It's phenomenal. So here at Triple Tail Charters, you've got the offshore game, which is swordfish, tuna fish, triple tail.
Yep.
And then you've got the inshore game, which Cade, that's your jam, right? You're the king of the close.
For the most part.
Yep. Yeah.
How do you find redfish?
Well, there's a lot of factors that go into it. Every day is different. They got the river. The Mississippi River plays a big factor in it with how it fluctuates every day.
How much can it fluctuate?
Well, not much. It really just depends on what's happening up north. I mean, we had a pretty drastic jump at the beginning of end of January. And so that kind of controls where we're fishing. But, I mean, it won't jump up much. I mean, it may gradually jump up a couple inches every day or so, or jump up a foot or so over 2 days or something like that. Not nothing drastic where it'll jump from 2 foot to 8 foot overnight. But no, typically, I mean, that Mississippi River, like I said, it plays a big factor because whenever that river comes up, it pushes a lot of that fresh water on top. It shoves those fish to the outsides. And so depending on that, we also got the wind. Depending on which direction the wind's blowing, depends on which area we're going to go. And then on top of that, we got the tide. So you may have perfect area set up with perfect wind conditions, but it may only be a foot and a half deep on high tide. So you can't go fish in that area, or you got to wait till the next day or something if the tide's different. And there's a lot of factors that go into it on how we make a game plan for the next morning or the next evening, whichever one we go do to fish. But there's a good bit into it that goes on. Like a lot of people, they're like, man, how do you know where you're going to go fish next? All these canes look the same.
They do. Yeah.
But, every point's different. Every cane's different. How the bait's coming across the canes. I mean, like today, a lot of spots that we fish weren't happening. Towards the end of the day, we got on this little spot. The wind was kind of cutting across it. And, I mean, it wasn't hot and heavy, but we made it happen. We caught fish. I mean, the closer to the grass, the better. And, it was a good day.
So I tried to fly fish today.
Yes. You gave it hell.
I feel like I tried pretty hard.
Yeah.
I've tried harder and failed before. But the painful thing about fly fishing today wasn't the wind, because the wind wasn't bad. I could cast it and I could get the fly where I needed to. I could present it the way I felt like I needed to. I tried every retrieve that I possibly could. I tried three or four different flies.
A couple different colors, too.
But, man, I knew that the fish were there. I could see the fish. If I threw your gear with bait, I was catching the fish. So, man, I pulled a minnow out of your bait, and I hooked it onto my minnow pattern, and I threw that out there and couldn't catch him. I put shrimp on there. I soaked my fly in shrimp juice and tried to catch him. I tried every dirty trick that would get me kicked out of the state of Montana that I could think of, and I couldn't do it. I could not catch a fish on the fly rod. And I started with gear, went to the fly, went back to gear, went back to the fly, went back to the gear. I think I probably caught 60 or 80 redfish today on shrimp under a popping cork, dead shrimp. And it was an incredible experience, but it's also humbling to be like, man, I feel like I'm presenting this fly in all the ways that I could. And I know that there's fish that are aware of it, but they're not going to try it. Visibility is a couple inches in this water.
Visibility is a big, big factor right now. You're not going to find any clean water. Yeah. Not inland right now, because like I said, that river has pushed so much dirty water to the outside, through all the cuts, through all the ponds, along all the banks and stuff. So, I mean, visibility, it looks, I mean, it's, don't get me wrong, it's pretty stained, but I mean, some of the flies you could see, say, 3 or 4 inches down. But with that being said, like right now, that with that river being up, the water is really cold. So where we were fishing at today, that water temp was 53 degrees.
You can feel it as soon as you hit the river.
Yeah.
The temperature
it's a 20
changes.
Degree difference change.
It just as soon as you hit the current, you can feel
drastic.
It. Yeah.
That's what we mess a lot of people up. We're like, hey, this time of the year, we're like, hey, look, dress warm for the boat ride out and a boat ride in.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to dress for three different seasons right now. I mean, it's cold in the morning, boat ride ends. I mean, while fishing, it's nice and warm in shorts and flip-flop, but a boat ride back on the river is cold.
Dude, I didn't get it. And I was seeing, you know, the videos that you're posting and stuff, and you guys are geared up like you're fishing for crab in the Bering Sea. And I was like, man, what is with these dudes? I know it's not cold down there.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I try really hard. I try really hard whenever I'm fishing or hunting in a new area to just listen to the people that are from there.
For sure.
And not bring my own prejudice and try and think that I know better. Because when I have clients do that, like, you're setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah.
Like, you may know more about fishing than me. You may know more about hunting than me. But you don't know more about hunting this species on this place than I do.
Yeah.
Right. Nobody does. I'm the best at this.
Yep.
And I'm invested in your success. And I want you to be comfortable and fed and to have a good time and to achieve your version of success, whatever that is. And I know that quality guides and outfitters and captains all feel the same way.
Yeah.
Right. So if you're out there and you're saying, hey, gear up, it's going to be cold, I need to listen to you.
Yeah.
And,
take their word for it.
And I'm glad that I did. I had three back-to-back trips on this run. So I started at the Western Hunting Expo. So I had to be dressed up and like looking nice. And then I was in the Florida Keys and now I'm here. So I've got to figure out how to manage all that into the luggage that I can bring on an airplane. Otherwise I would have been wearing, you know, my Gruden's bibs and, looking like you guys ready to, you know, do battle with some fish. But no, it's surprising. It's surprising to come here in so many different ways because it's just not like any other place I've been.
Yeah. No, it's one of a kind for sure.
Oh, yeah.
The hurricane had the hurricanes have had a pretty significant impact on this area.
Big time.
I'm starting to realize that just about everything that I'm seeing here is new, right?
Yeah.
Everything's been rebuilt.
You said, you know, your family had a place down here?
Yeah, right there in Burris.
Yeah, and it's gone.
Gone. The only thing left was the pilings that the house sat on. That was it.
And how high was it above the ground?
It was, I think it was 17 foot, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's how, from the ground to the top of the pilings, it was 17 foot.
And that wasn't enough.
That wasn't enough.
There's over 30 feet of water here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, some areas it was just over 30 foot.
Good grief. Man, Blake, you're invested here as a business, as a profession, like you're building your life around this place. What do you just feel like that's just hanging over your head, that the wrong storm could come and take it all away from you at any point?
Yeah, I mean it's definitely something I worry about, but You know, one thing that I've learned is things that I don't have control over, I really don't stress about a whole lot, you know. Take it one day at a time, and yeah, I'll figure it out if that, you know, when that time comes, if it does, you know.
Tell me about Ransom. I love to talk about my boat. I think everybody that owns a boat
for sure
loves it, loves to talk about it. I know you love your boat.
Yeah, no doubt.
Tell me about that thing.
Workhorse.
Yep. So, I mean, I started out, you know, when I first started fishing, I ran a 38-foot fountain with trips, you know, and that's...
What's a fountain for folks that don't know? I mean, people are listening to this in Bulgaria right now.
It's a big center console, and that was one of the first ones, you know, maybe other than Contender, that built kind of a big monohull fishing hole.
Okay.
You know, that was like a 2007 model that I started in, you know, and I thought it was, you know, the best thing out there. I mean, I was, you know, it was a big boat and badass to me, and, you know, and then I fished that thing for like 5 years, and, you know, that's in, and Freeman built a really badass catamaran, and I rode in one of those, and I was, you know, I was blown away.
What is a catamaran?
I don't even know how to explain it really, but.
So it's got like two holes,
yeah.
Right? So there's the bottom of it is shaped like a W.
Yeah.
Would be a way to say it.
So you got a big tunnel in the middle, you know, where in that. The big thing, you know, with the tunnel going through the middle is you get that airflow through there. So you get to get a lot of lift on a big, heavy hull, you know, with that. And that's the biggest thing, you know, on those boats, really. And that air underneath there is the cushion for when a boat comes down off of a wave, you know, because that's, you know, makes you have a softer landing.
Right.
You know, versus like, you know, feeling like you're landing on cement.
Yeah. And then... the individual parts that come down that run parallel to each other, they're sharper than the profile of, you know, a monohull boat.
For sure, yeah.
So they cut into those waves better.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly smooth and stable ride.
It is, yeah.
I'm very impressed by that. So you like the Freeman design.
Yeah, so I like the Freeman design a lot, and I liked, you know, I liked metal boats. Because I like, you know, yeah. I like a workhorse. I love fishing and I like using a boat. I don't like the maintenance and the upkeep, you know, of a fiberglass and keeping a boat, you know,
pretty.
You know, pretty. I like to fish, you know, and I wanted a metal boat, you know, and so I took a huge risk, you know. I had a buddy of mine that was a fabricator and could build anything, you know, and anything he did was just absolutely incredible and top notch. And he really took pride in his work. And I had, you know, him and his dad, you know, I trusted him, you know, with it. And I wasn't even worried about it, honestly, which me being younger, you know, helped with that as well, because there's a lot of things that could have went wrong and it could be a complete disaster. But he told me he could do it. And I said, when can you start? And, you know, and he said, next week. You know, and so we ordered, you know, $7,000 in materials, you know, within a couple of days, you know, of just talking about it. And
just like aluminum and stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
Just big sheets of aluminum, you know, and after that point, there's no turning back. And then it's like, you know, I'm watching this thing from the ground up, you know, and it's doesn't really, you know, it starts to hit you when it's halfway through and you're seeing it. It's like, you know, what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was really an incredible deal, you know. It's like it was neat, you know. And then when the boat was getting so close, and you can't just go half-ass build it and then go run it and decide, oh yeah, it runs good, let's finish it out. Like, it would be so much work and so much money just to test it like that.
Yeah.
That's like you're all in, you got to finish this thing and put it on and hope it floats, basically, you know. And I had the guy that was powering it for me. He knows a lot about boats, and, you know, and it's, you know, Metro Boats that sells Mercury's up there. He's powered it and wired it all up for me. And I was actually, it was in my off season when I was deer hunting, and we kind of didn't know when the boat was going to be ready, and it got close and I was gone, and he was like, it's ready to go. And I was like, dude, freaking go run it. And one afternoon when they finished up, they went right before dark, and I was so nervous I didn't even want to be there. And he took it out for like freaking just a couple minutes, and I just wanted to know, did it drive straight? And, you know, the RPMs, that the speed, and what he told me, you know, it was like time to celebrate, you know?
That's so awesome.
It was a neat deal.
How old were you at that time?
I think 26.
Okay.
When that would be, I'm pretty sure, 26 when that was done.
So, you know, ballparking it, taking a $500,000 business risk at age 26, just trusting that your buddy's going to be able to fabricate something from an idea.
Yeah.
Dude.
It's wild.
High risk, high reward, right?
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, you keep getting drawn to this type of thing. Like, that's who you are as a personality.
For sure.
But I've talked about this before. I talk about it probably too much. But I think that risk tends to pay off.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No doubt about
it. Tends to pay off. Because without it, you're not going to get that payoff.
No.
You might get by.
Yeah.
But you might not also.
Yep.
But unless you take that risk, you're not going to see that highest level of success, that thing that people can't imagine. And for somebody to come down here and book a trip with you, like for me coming to do this, this is a high risk for me. This is an expensive trip. Like,
for sure.
I have to work extremely hard to come up with the money to do this.
No doubt.
And, you know, it takes a lot of days for me to work enough to save extra to be able to do this. It's a really big deal. And then we ended up having to shift dates a little bit. And I looked at the calendar and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be there on a full moon. Oh,
yeah.
What have I done? What have I done? You know, cause I've been just burned by the moon so many times.
I know.
It'll get you.
Okay. Well, you know what? We're going to do it. And, we got here and, the first night we went down here to the other marina, and there's a restaurant that that oversees this marina, and we see these boats pull up and we're eating dinner, and of course we're all excited and a little bit nervous, and we're watching everybody pull fish out of the boats, and like one tuna comes out of the whole fleet.
Yeah, it does.
And it was a monster.
Not looking good. Yeah,
but I was like, yeesh, could be rugged, but all right, you know, still here, still cool, having a good time. And then, just as luck would have it, but also luck combined with preparation and in the right mindset and the right attitudes. And, you know, you can't overvalue being ready.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's the advantage you have. And that's one thing big with me with fishing and catching big fish is, you know, there's a lot of things that can go wrong and that you do have control over, like tackle failures, you know, and that's one thing that I've seen. Like, I want to cut that percentage out as much as I possibly can, because one bite makes my entire day, like makes a badass day or a terrible day. So if I have, you know, I want to avoid that, you know.
What's the most scared you've ever been on the water?
I mean, I'd say probably getting caught, you know, like in some summertime squalls, you know, which is not often, but it's your calmest time of the year in the summer. But you get in some storms that just pop up so quick, like they build up over your head and there's lightning popping all around, you know, and when, as soon as that happens and I see that, I'm looking, you know, like I'm finding, you know, a rig, because, you know, an oil rig is taller than me. I can get tucked up under it. So I know that I'm not going to get struck, you know, if I do that. So that's kind of your safe spot, which is a lot of in the Gulf, but I'd say that, you know, and then the winds pick up and it gets cold. You're getting chills down your spine and people are obviously getting nervous. I'm never really scared because, you know, it's like I'm out there. So it is what it is. There's no, you can't go anywhere. You know, you got to figure out what you're going to do and make the call. And I'm always, you know, if I'm going to head in, if there's a lightning storm, I'm going to take cover. And then, you know, if I don't think it's that bad, then I'm going to be heading north. And there's no going around it. There's no running away from it, like everybody says with the big boats, because it gets so rough. You know, you can hardly go anywhere a lot of times. But, you know, it's one of those things, you know, it's Mother Nature.
Lightning is humbling.
Yeah, it is.
You can only be brave up to a point.
Yeah.
Anybody. I was fishing for salmon at home a few years ago, and it was on April 28th. And I keep that date in my mind because the fishing ended up being so good that I want to fish that date forever. Mm-hmm. But this storm started coming, and I saw the sky get black out to the north. And I got an alert on my phone that said lightning strike 20 miles an hour. And I was like, all right. And then, boom, both rods go at once. They're reeling two fish, and they're big. I was like, whew, that was kind of fun. Start setting lines back out. Boom, boom. As soon as I can, like, while they're just going out, I'm getting them. And the limit's 30 per person. And I'm just plugging the cooler at this point.
Yeah.
Like, getting fish in as fast as I possibly can. It's going hard. And then I get the alert 10 miles out. I was like, okay, getting serious, probably coming this way. I think it's going to miss me. I think it's going to go to the north. And then 5 miles out, I get the alert. Now I'm seeing it, and all the other boats leave. I'm like, it's too good. So I get my Yeti cooler, and I put it in the back of the boat, and I'm kneeling on my Yeti cooler like that's going to save me. And I can reach each rod, and I'm still bailing fish into the boat, you know. And then it hit the lake, and that was the first time I'd ever seen lightning like hit the water close to me before, because usually I'm smarter.
Yeah.
And I was like, good enough, and I left the rods in, man, and I pinned it, and I skidded my boat up the ramp and ran and hid in my truck until it was over. But, yeah, you can be brave up to a point, but when it gets real personal, nobody's brave in it.
Nah.
Yeah. Because it feels like
– it would just be – stupidity at that point.
It is.
If you think
it totally
that
is.
It's not dangerous.
Yeah, and that it's not going to get you, that you're special or something.
Yeah.
And I don't know what happens when lightning strike hits an aluminum boat, but I think it's bad.
Yeah, it's not a good deal.
Yeah, I bet it melts something.
Yeah, guaranteed. I mean, that's the other scary part, is there's a very good chance that, you know, nobody's going to get hurt, but if, you know, all your electronics get fried and all that, you still got a real serious problem.
What about you, Kay? Do you ever get scared on the water?
Yeah. I mean, I've been out, because I do some snapper fishing and stuff, and we've been out in some nasty stuff where, same thing, summertime squalls brew up, and I'm not in a 38-foot boat. I'm in a 24, 25-foot bay boat with one motor, one VHF radio, and it'll tighten you up a little bit, but that's for sure. No, nothing really crazy inshore. So actually right before Ida had came through, we were fishing about 2 days prior to it. And I mean, before the storm came, I mean, it had some nasty squalls, and we didn't cancel because they were supposed to come later in the morning. And we were out there, and I was watching the radar. I was watching the weather on the radar. As we were fishing, we were tucked in a little canal. I mean, wind was blowing 35, 40, not ideal. But we were out there getting it done, and we tucked away and just steadily just watched the weather as it came closer and closer, and started hearing some lightning crack. And I was like, man, you know, it's just not even worth it, guys. We gotta make a run while we can. And so we put the poles down, fired it up, and we made a run for it, and we were crossing the bay, and it just hit us. And I mean, good thing for having radar. I was running Blake's Isle of Mirada at the time. And good thing we had radar, because I mean, the wall of rain, it was so thick. I mean, literally had to run the radar because I couldn't see 20 feet in front of me, just a solid gray wall. And you can ask my brother, you go look back at the track line. The track line that I made that day was not ideal, but we made it through. We crossed over some pipeline crosses we shouldn't have crossed, but we didn't blow nothing up, and we made it back in safe. And but other than that, I mean, everything's been pretty good. But that's probably the most sketchy time I've had out there.
People up north think everybody in Louisiana is a Cajun, but what is a Cajun?
Well, I mean, there's Cajuns, there's Creoles, there's Coonasses.
What's the difference?
It's really hard to say. I mean, it's really the way everybody talks, the way everybody does things, and the way they cook stuff. But
who's the best at cooking? Not coon asses, I'm guessing.
No, I don't know. I mean, probably coon asses. Really? We just throw shit together. You can't follow a recipe. You just got to – you're looking at it. You're drinking you a beer or something while cooking, and you're like, maybe I'll throw a little bit more of this in there. Or try adding this to it. And then next thing you know, that somebody tells you, man, that was some good food. How'd you do that? And you just have to tell them, I don't really remember, but I'll try it again.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, we got some good food down here.
When I've had Creole or Cajun food in other places, it's just painfully spicy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll sweat eating ketchup, you know. I don't agree with that stuff. And I was asking a buddy prior to this trip about eating Cajun food, and I was like, man, I feel like my face is going to be on fire down there. And he said, look, when you eat actual Cajun and Creole food, it's different. Like, there's flavors in it. It's not just
everything kind of binds together.
Man, we ate at Creole House and Oyster Bar in New Orleans before we came down here. It was some of the best food I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal, and just flavors that I've never ever experienced before. That is a really special thing about this area. And I think it's cool how, you know, how French influence ever ended up here, and how different it is from like French Canadians or, you know, other pockets of French who are out in the world. Like, this is a really special and unique group of people, and the culinary tradition that came out of that, and then your connection to land and natural resources and hunting and fishing on top of it. Dude, it's something that people need to put on their list of coming to experience a little bit. Yeah. I want to talk conservation a little bit. There's something that you told me about, Blake, that's bothering me deeply. And we've got all these oil rigs out there in the Gulf of Mexico, and a lot of them are not being used anymore.
Yeah.
How critical is that infrastructure to wildlife? Is it a problem for wildlife? Is it a good thing?
Oh, it's the best thing you could ever have. I mean, it's like a man-made reef, you know, that's been there, a lot of them, you know, since the 80s, you know. And it's like, that's what blows my mind, is that, you know, they're when they're not using them, they want to tear them down, you know. And
that's the crazy thing to me.
It blows my mind, yeah.
So, folks, what they're doing, they've got all these oil rigs out here, and there's pressure to go and set explosives on them,
yeah,
and destroy them, instead of just leaving them there to be this critical marine habitat.
Yep.
Like, the marine life here is by far benefited from having that infrastructure and those artificial reefs out there. And if you take that away, you're going to be killing all these animals.
Yeah, it's terrible, you know. And then, like you said, they'll blow the rigs up, you know, to cut them off from the bottom. And I mean, there's plenty of videos you can find of just fish floating, you know, by the thousands, and they're ripping them up, and they're just acting like no harm's done, you know. And then at the same time, cutting our limits back for certain species, you know, a lot of snappers and your bottom fish is what it's mostly really harming. But it's just, you know, it's a corrupt deal, like a lot of other things, you know. It's sure.
Somebody's getting paid.
Yep, it's okay. A money making machine. And
well, it is frustrating. It's also a spectacle to see how much life is around those things.
For sure.
It's truly phenomenal. And for people who haven't spent time in the ocean, you might look at them and just see this big rusty piece of metal and think that it's a disaster. But if you spend any time there, you're going to realize that without that, there are just thousands and thousands of large animals and millions of small ones that would no longer have a home.
No doubt.
Yeah. The other conservation thing that I feel very strongly compelled to talk about is sharks. A huge number of the fish that we're trying to reel in the Florida Keys got bit by sharks on the way in. You know, I heard chatter over the radios while we were out here fishing that, you know, there was potentially hundreds, if not thousands, of tuna that had gotten eaten by sharks while people were trying to catch them this year.
Yeah.
Sharks are incredibly protected right now, and the population has exploded.
Yeah.
And the number of sharks that I'm seeing in so many places feels like there's an offset and there's, you know, a bad imbalance with too many predators.
Yeah, there's way too many.
You've been fishing your whole life. Like, how has this changed in your lifetime?
I mean, it's gotten way worse in the past 5 years for sure. You know, there's a lot of sharks that are definitely getting more educated with more boats fishing, you know, and, you know, they've a lot of big duskies in particular, you know, have gotten dialed in certain areas. When these tunas get in certain areas, that's, you know, they're going to be there. And that's one thing that's really made me jump for like from the gear that I use and that big braid and big mono, you know, 250-pound mono, you know, leader, so that when I hook these 150-pound fish, I can get them to the boat in minutes, you know, and not feed them to sharks because
right. You know, take away that risk of exposure
for sure.
And every time that a shark eats a tuna that's on a line, he's learning to do that. So it's just going to get worse and worse. So for the people that are hearing that, you know, we're using reels the size of a coffee can and, you know, 250-pound test and all this crazy stuff to like really put power into these fish, it's beneficial in a couple ways. And I think, you know, one of the big ones is they're not getting eaten by sharks. We didn't have a single fish get shark bit.
No.
And then another one is the quality of the meat is higher if you can get that fish in when it's green.
Yeah. So that fish doesn't get hot, you know, it's quick and he doesn't use a bunch of energy because he's to the boat and dead, you know?
And if we're talking about like some of the best fish in the world.
Yeah. It's like been incredible.
The purpose for me of coming down here, you know, I was really coming down here to get meat. And the experience was a huge part of it, but the meat is a huge part of it too.
Like, absolutely.
I'm going to be completely honest about that. So getting the highest quality meat possible and a good quantity of meat to be able to share with my friends and family.
Yeah.
Dude, what a gift to be bringing this high quality yellowfin tuna that's so fatty.
I know it.
All the way back to Oregon here in a couple of days.
Yeah.
Like, what a time to be alive that, you know, smashed between a mountain wilderness and Hell's Canyon, I'm going to be able to take.
Unreal.
Bring my friends over and make them sushi.
Yeah.
From fish that I caught.
You know where it came from and it's been handled properly and, you know, taken care of and not from the store and
caught
you
with
know.
The real electrical tape to the rod.
Yeah.
Pieced together.
We just looked at that reel scene. You know, we'd had it all taped up. I never really got to take a close look at it. But, man, that thing just exploded.
Oh, yeah.
So much power.
Yeah. It was – I don't know if the drag locked up on that reel. And it just – I don't know. Something had to give or what happened, you know, because that was a new reel. And, honestly, that was the first fish on that reel, you know. And
well, the drag worked the rest of the time.
I know it. So, I don't know. It was – that was – that was wild. It was fun, you know.
Like, you know, I put some heave ho into setting that hook, but I don't feel like I was like doing it hard enough to blow stuff up. But
I know it.
You combine that with a fish that has just hit the gas pedal, and then you're going to send it into him with 80-pound braid that, you know, has zero stretch in it. Like, something's going to give.
Yeah. That's real deal.
Dude, I can't think both of you enough for the experience that you provided. This is something that I'll remember my entire life. And the advice that I would give to anybody who wants to come down and do this trip is book a minimum of 3 days, a bare minimum. You need a day of inshore, right? And that'll give you some flexibility because if the weather's bad, you can stand close and you can go and fish for redfish and the other inshore species that you have. And then you need 2 days offshore if you're going to be going after tuna or swordfish because it doesn't happen every day.
No doubt. It's high risk, high reward type fishing. You know, you're catching once in a lifetime fish, honestly.
And this is the last civilization on the Mississippi River. This is the end of the river.
Yep. End of the road.
Yeah, very much so. So if you come all the way down here, it doesn't like this is the southernmost point of the deep south. You come all the way down here, you need to make it worth it, and then give yourself the time to enjoy and experience it, and increase your chances of finding that fish that is going to be carved into your DNA for the rest of your life.
Yep.
Yeah. What other advice do you have to people who might be interested in coming down here? Like, what do they need to know?
I mean,
come try it out.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know. It's not that they have to know so much, you know. I mean, we, you know, really people, they don't have to be good fishermen. You don't, you know, you can have experience or not have any at all. And it's an incredible thing the way we have it set up. I mean, you know, we're out here every day. So, you know, you show up with food and drinks and, you know, we can, you know, still make stuff happen, you know. And I mean, it's obviously you're offshore, so conditions can change. You can get caught in some nasty weather, but I'm pretty good about calling that and letting people know what they're getting into. And, you know, I'll let people reschedule if they want, if I tell them, you know, this is how it's looking and stuff like that. So
yeah,
just try to make it, you know, a good experience. I want somebody to leave with, you know, good things to say, not like, oh, I'm never going offshore again because I brought them out in nasty conditions, you know. And right. some Fair certain enough. Crews you could bring in nasty conditions and they don't care because they've been in it and they know how it is. But I'm pretty good about talking to people and, you know, figuring out what they want to do and letting them kind of, you know, make the call on, you know, what I'm, you know, with what's going on.
I'll tell you another thing that I really appreciated is you're willing to let me get involved in every aspect of it that I was interested in. So, you know, if you're butchering a fish that's worth $5,000 or $6,000, you don't want to screw that up. And I certainly don't either, but yeah. I really wanted to take part in that and clean one of those fish. And you were patient with me and showed me every single cut and let me do all that myself. And you really took time to just make sure that I was getting the experience that I wanted. And a lot of people don't do that, man, because it's harder. It's more work.
Yeah.
It's easier to be like, man, why don't you, you know, go back to your hotel room and drink a beer and, you know, come back in 2 hours and this will be done. But, you know, for me, I want to be there for that.
For sure.
I want to do everything except for, you know, scrub the boat. And that's what you got Kyle for. I've scrubbed plenty of boats. And
no doubt.
Know, he needs that time.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. All right. So if somebody wants to come down and go sword fishing, go tuna fishing, go triple tail fishing, go red fishing, how do they do it? How do they get a hold of you?
The best way would be like, I post a lot of my recent stuff on Instagram, and my Instagram's Captain Blake, CAPT.Blake, and my phone number is big, you know, so people want to get a hold of me.
And your phone number is on your Instagram on a lot of those posts, so people can find it. We're not going to talk about it here in front of this audience. So same thing, if you want to go inshore fishing, same thing, just get a hold of Blake and they'll make it happen for you. Guys, we're going to wrap this up. Again, I want to tell you thank you very much. Looking forward to another great day of fishing tomorrow. Going to be windier. Might still try with my fly rod.
You never know until you know.
You never know. I'm certainly not going to catch him if I don't try. It'd be pretty satisfying if I do run into an aggressive one. But, looking forward to that and looking forward to bringing all this meat home. And, again, just very, very grateful for the opportunity and the experience and sharing all this. It's been fun. Yeah,
that was awesome.
So 10 out of 10 would recommend to a friend. Bye, everybody.
I just want to take a second and thank everyone who has written a review, who has sent mail, who has sent emails, who has sent messages. Your support is incredible. And I also love running into you at trade shows and events and just out on the hillside when we're hunting. I think that that's fantastic. I hope you guys keep adventuring as hard and as often as you can. Art for the Six Ranch podcast was created by John Chatelain and was digitized by Celia Harlander. Original music was written and performed by Justin Hay, and the Six Ranch podcast is now produced by Six Ranch Media. Thank you all so much for your continued support of the show, and I look forward to next week when we can bring you a brand new episode.